Clariton Conversation. My name is Katie Asbester, and our guest today is Tansy Spinks, an artist who uses sound, a musician, and an analog photographer. She's also the senior lecturer of MA in Fine Arts at Middlesex University. Tansy, let's just start off with this question of being an analog photographer, because I'm holding in my hands a book that you contributed the artwork to called Insights. Now, your photography is being collected by not just the V&A, but also the National Media Museum in Brantford and the Fine Art Museum in Houston. So you're an internationally recognized photographer. And you have very kindly donated some of your artwork to a fundraiser for motor neurons disease called, and the book is called Insights, 15 Stories Exploring Disability. And your artwork graces the cover, and 12 or 15 photographs on the inside? What are we looking at here? I guess 15. And you say these are analog photographs. I'm not really sure what analog photographs are. Can you just help me out with that?
Well, analog, it's a funny word. We hadn't really heard the word analog until digital came along. So it's essentially not digital. In other words, ordinary, old-fashioned photography using wet processes, essentially.
Dark rooms. So we're talking dark rooms.
Dark rooms, yeah. Getting your negatives made properly through a sort of properly little listen to me using developing tanks and printing everything in the dark room.
And so, what's the advantage of that over digital? Because I thought the great glory of digital is that you can endlessly manipulate the image.
Well, when I started out, of course, there was no digital, so that's what I learned. That's what we all learned. That's how photography happened. And it took a very long time for digital to even catch up in terms of quality. It's just an alchemical process. It's very magical being in a dark room. You're like an alchemist. It's nothing compared to digital, I have to say. You know, the digital is just, you know, sitting behind a screen, which we do so much anyway. So
this is much more fun.
A bit old-fashioned in that respect.
Okay, well, that's clearer now. What about the statement that you're an artist using sound? What does that mean?
Well, we have many senses that we bring to our art practices, and the sense of listening and what our ears bring to our practices and to our ideas is something I'm really fascinated by. And, sound can be to many things to an artist. It can be something you use in an installation. It can involve interviews, field recordings. But my particular area of interest is performing live, especially site-specifically. So I'll go to a place, having researched it, and come across some aspect of the place that I want to impart in sound, and will make it difficult to explain. But I'll perform, for example, with objects that are related to the place, or objects that I've found that are equivalent to something that happened in the place to do with its history or its anecdotal stories related to the place. So, for example, I did a piece on the sea forts off the North Kent coast, these incredible World War II gun platforms. And I managed to get out there for a couple of hours and put microphones on the fabric of the space, and also took an instrument out with me, because I play the violin, or have done fairly seriously. I learnt as a child. So the piece of sound art was a recording of the playing of the, and when I say playing, you know, hitting the objects or activating in some way the surfaces of this sea fort, and then improvising on this electric violin at the same time, making a sound piece. It's on my website. There's all sorts of objects, sound objects, as you might call them, on my website.
We'll have to check it out. I recommend everybody check out the website. Okay. What is your website, Tansy?
It's www.tansyspinks.com. That's TansySpinks.com.
So how do you get started in a life of being a sound artist? Where does this journey start for you, Tansy?
It's been a long journey. I mean, I knew I was going to be an artist right from the very beginning of, you know, first thing that I would say when anyone asked me as a child, what are you going to be? Well, it's an artist. You know, there was never any question I'd do anything else. So I went to art school, and at the same time as playing the violin, and I tossed a coin at the age of 18 as to decide whether to go to art school or music school. And I thought that probably art schools gave me more of a sense of a chance to experiment and to cross disciplines and to try things out. So off I went to art school, a BA in Fine Art at Leeds, where there was quite a lot of alternative performance work happening. So we had visits from artists like Gavin Bryars, who ran this extraordinary thing at the time called the Portsmouth Sinfonia, which was an orchestra of people playing instruments who couldn't play instruments. So it was an approximation of something like, you know, for example, if you ever hear any recordings at the Portsmouth Sinfonia having a go at Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, for example, it is hilarious, excruciating. Apparently people used to walk out of their performances quite regularly.
Well, fair enough.
There was something very democratic about that, which I found really inspiring. And the fact you didn't necessarily have to have invested huge numbers of hours to hone your skill. You could actually, you know, take part in music or sound making very fairly with others. And someone like Cornelius Cardew has been quite an influence in that respect. And he was known as a composer initially, but someone who invented the Scratch Orchestra, which was an improvised evening class at Morley College originally, whereby anyone could sign up and make a contribution to making sounds. And they devised all these improvisatory techniques that really helped with the sound making. So that's been a relatively recent inspiration. But all the way through art school, it niggled away at me that I'd got this, you know, this visual art practice, but that the music and the sound work that I was doing didn't really marry with that. And somebody once said to me, well, why aren't you bringing the sound into your practice? You know, it's pretty obvious. So
you cross genres, you cross disciplines is what you did.
Yes, or you invent one that's between the disciplines. You know, yes. It's something that's neither one nor the other. But so at the Royal College of Art, where I did my MA in photography, I finished my MA show with a six projector AV piece, which was six wonderful old analog slide projectors, so Kodak slide projectors, those carousels that sort
I remember them well.
Went round and clicked.
Yeah, I mean, anybody younger than us won't know what we're talking
wonderful
about. But
quality, the quality you get from you used to get from there, and the lenses were great, of course.
Yes.
So six projectors all stacked up on top of the other, all are programmed by a sound tape, sort of tape that then prompted the sounds to trigger the projectors to move. And it was a very sophisticated setup in those days. You could get almost four images per second coming out, so it was like a sort of massive animation exercise using stills images, but at a speed that made them feel like a film. And it was, the quality was great, and it's a medium that's sort of died. It's gone, it's been taken over, but I really rose to that as something that was very inspiring at the time.
Well, let me ask you something, Terence. You know, I think every parent's soul quakes when their child says they want to become an artist. Were your parents completely...
They were completely supportive, no.
Oh, you got so lucky.
Yeah, my mother painted, my grandmother painted. It was sort of in the family.
To,
my mother had wanted to go to be a... go, my grandmother had wanted to be at dance school, and it wasn't considered appropriate. And so I think there was a sort of a history of the women in the family being somewhat thwarted, not able to go to art.
Yeah, good for your mother, though, for saying, this may have happened to me, but it's not happened to my daughter. Mm. I take my hat off to her. Because, so many people who have their thwarted ambitions end up, you know, being part of the system and not...
But, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the creative industries, which are much vaunted by the government, bring in millions.
150 million a year.
So, of course, art is important. I mean, you're not sure where it's going to take you when you start out, and there are just so many avenues, and there are areas that you can create for yourself. So it's not a matter necessarily of following in a particular tradition or a particular, you know, taking a particular trajectory in terms of what you're doing.
Yes, but it's just a huge
risk.
It's
such an important subject, you know.
Yes.
And it absolutely horrifies me that it's not valued in schools at the moment. Music and art are very much seen as sort of peripheral subjects, and for me they're absolutely integral to everything. Actually, there's an artist called Bob and Roberta Smith in a one-man band, and he maintains that every school should be an art school, every primary school should be an art school, and from the art spins out all the things that youngsters need to address, obviously the literacy, the numeracy, the sciences, the histories, but it all comes from music and art. And of course you can add, you know, dance and drama to that.
Yes.
There's four forgotten areas in schools, which I think is a tragedy, actually.
it also suggests that the only it's not just that individuals are under touched, you know, they need that education is not drawing out their inner abilities, and as a result our economy is weakened because so much this is a huge part of our economy. It's that we have narrowed the definition of what it is to be human.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, this isn't just about education and the economy, it's about a definition of what is the human self. And that's what we have in this neoliberal age. We have reduced it down to being a money earner, a money spinner.
And something that's accountable.
Yes, constantly. Accountable, quantifiable, measurable. Mm-hmm. And the ability of us to express ourselves and yearn to express ourselves in other ways is just it's not just denigrated, it's denied.
Yeah, and it's not just a matter of expressing yourself. You know, I mean, I try to make quite a clear differentiation, especially with my students, that this is not therapy. You know, if you want to do art therapy, you go somewhere else. It's obviously therapy is important when you're working with others, but it's much more to do with having a voice and allowing art to highlight the things that are perhaps wrong with society or that are interesting about society, or, you know, just that moment of getting your audience, your viewers, to do a double take and think, oh yeah, that's interesting, you know, that's really interesting, I hadn't looked at it that way before. If you make that happen, then you're really successful. You know, that's a great moment as an artist to just, you know, for the penny to drop for someone else. It's very exciting, and then you build on that as you progress through your practice.
Yes, this might be boring for everybody, so I'm going to try and keep this down to a soundbite. But Karl Marx, when he was talking about the division of the proletariat from the product of his labor, actually takes it right back to the initial time of industrialization. He said the problem is ultimately man, and he meant men, he didn't mean women. Man is a creative animal. And when you become specialized in running a piece of machinery, your creativity is stripped from you, and you have lost something essential of what it is to be human. Now, he didn't explore that idea because then he went off into economics, which I think is fair enough. That was his actual interest. But I always found that slightly, it was like, you know, it made me kind of blink. Of all the things you think Karl Marx is going to say, you wouldn't have thought that one of them would be man is essentially creative. And the travesty of modernity is that we don't acknowledge that.
Well, I take a lot of inspiration from someone like William Morris, I think, who obviously in the late 19th century very much questioned these things and reintroduced the idea of the craft and the handmade, the artisan, if you like, a much maligned word at the moment, and the value of getting involved with stuff, with materials, with the outdoors, with being creative yourself, whether it's making pots, whether it's drawing, and the value, especially. I mean, someone like Ruskin also talked about that in relation to the working man and how drawing was, you know, an extraordinary way of expressing yourself also, but just connecting with things. It's a good way of, it's almost like meditation. It's a good way of really connecting.
So how did you end up at being a lecturer of fine arts?
I'm not full-time, so I'm still an artist.
Okay.
Keep that distinction. I think it's just something that, as an artist, you knew was possible. Certainly in the days when I first started out, you know, the mid to late 80s, I just applied. It was a job in The Guardian, 0.5, lecturer in art at Middlesex. And Middlesex had been... it was a polytechnic then, of course. It was an art school that I had on my radar because it, a bit like Leeds and a bit like a number of other more liberal-based fine art courses. It was one of those places known to encourage students' individuality rather than have any sort of house style. And in many ways, I would say we still maintain that ethos, but we really encourage the students to be the individuals that they are and to bring out something within their ideas and their practice that that's rewarding for them, but also for a wider audience.
But how do you...
Problem solvers, you know, they're... I could always spot a Middlesex student. I've been teaching for way over 30 years there now. A lot of ex-Middlesex students are out there, fine arts students. And they're often the ones just slightly quirky, but really making something happen or You know, the problem-solving aspect is a very important part of being an artist, I think. And you can apply it to other fields and other disciplines. So we've got students who are, you know, running the arts departments in local councils or major pop stars. I mean, someone like Alison Goldfrapp, for example, is one of our fine art students. So you just never know where the discipline of fine art and the way of thinking that fine art encourages will take you.
How do you... okay, so maybe we're getting a bit off piece here. One of the difficulties, I would imagine, teaching fine arts, when you express it in terms of individual projects, is how you go about judging whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. And that always struck me as tricky, very tricky.
That's a very good question, and I think I often say to the students, well, it's a luxury if I like your work. It's not about liking the work. It's more to do with the students themselves, their level of curiosity, their level of engagement and commitment. And then you have sort of other criteria you'll look at, you know, whether it's skill or process based. But again, it's to do with to what extent they've really engaged with the area that they maintain that they're interested in. So the ones who do best are the ones who are in making things or being involved in making things and, you know, absolutely taking on the whole research and context sort of aspect of what they're doing as well.
Oh, fantastic. Let's take a break for a moment and hear from our sponsors.
Everything written needs an editor. As Stephen King once said, to write is human, to edit is divine. Could be a memoir you wrote about growing up, or a collection of grandma's recipes, or a copy for business statements, or a racing page turner that you want to present to agents. For highly experienced and professional editing at a reasonable price, contact Clapham Publishing, www.claphampublishing.com, for all your writing needs.
We're back with our guest today, Tansy Spinks, and we have found in her vault a music selection, which we're going to play for you. And I hope you enjoy it. Tansy, tell us a bit about this music.
I didn't really call it music, actually.
I'm sorry. I beg your pardon. It's sound.
because as soon as you say the word music, there are all those assumptions that it will have, I don't know, melody or rhythm or skill, you know. So actually music is quite a loaded term, which is something I discussed in my PhD, which I did, you know, later on in life. We'll come to that in a moment, I think. So yes, we had a bit of a discussion about what might be most of interest. We could have a snippet from the Seaforts piece, but I also thought that you might like to hear this multi-layered voice piece I did for a commission for a gallery in Leeds. And I was asked to respond to Leeds United Football Ground as a sort of device for an exhibition. And I decided to listen to as many football chants as I could, because when I was a student in Leeds, I used to hear the Leeds United football crowd cheering from a distance, and it was the most extraordinary and quite chilling sound, you know, to hear 40,000 voices just raising, mm-hmm. Great excitement, you know, or when there was a goal, or the cheering and the singing of the chants. Just coming into my little living room as a student, it was very powerful. So I thought I'd revisit that memory as a sort of tribute to that, really. And I found 45 different football chants that relate to Leeds United, 45 minutes being the length of a half a football match, which is what I'd been asked to fill for this exhibition. I then just took it on myself to learn them and sing them, and worked with a sound recordist who'd got a microphone from that period, just to help sort of give a bit of authenticity to the voice. So the sound work for that piece is 45 different songs gradually coming in a sort of staged manner, drifting in and out, with me singing these very rumbustuous lyrics, but in a very choir girl sort of voice.
Okay, well, we won't be hearing...
There's a bit of an irony to it there, I think.
We won't be listening to 45 minutes of it, but we'll certainly be listening to hear a small selection. That's something tense. That's quite unique. What kind of reaction did you get from that piece of music? Song.
It was played in a gallery to very few people. It was played over a couple of weeks, I think. You know, I don't think anyone would have sat through the whole thing. I think there's an appreciation that there's this great disparity between the what would normally be a group of male voices singing in a very slight, well, I don't know, say drunken, but I mean, you know, in a very fulsome way. And I interpret these songs in a much quieter, very contemplative way, which I hoped would sound like I was just singing in my head, you know, almost as if you're humming to yourself. So that was picked up on by some people. And
the discontinuity between how we're used to hearing these sounds and hearing you alter them, and as a result it has a different meaning, a different context.
Yeah,
you change the context, so. You change the voice, and suddenly you've got a completely different sound
take
coming out.
It. Yeah, absolutely. And it's sort of reenactment in a way, which is something I've been doing in quite a bit of my practice. You know, recreating things that maybe other artists have done, but by me in a different era with a different set of values and approaches. Just a question, really. The status quo here and there.
Good. So, how did you end up bringing? Like, what is the process by which you leave art school and become active in sound?
That's a very good question. That's been a long journey. I had a bit of a life-changing experience in my mid to late 40s, which made me readdress what I was doing in my life and what I hadn't done, and made me revisit that question that a colleague had said is, why don't you bring your visual art and your sound art together in a more coherent way?
And are you prepared?
And I signed up to do a PhD.
Okay, good for you.
That very thing. And I did it part-time over 6 years and based the PhD around 20 sound artworks that were site-specific that I then used as a device to sort of comment on what sound art is and how research can inform live site-specific performance.
Okay, that's a lot to unpack. Let's just stop.
Yeah, it is.
Okay,
really.
So there's two parts. What sound artistry is, and how research can deepen our understanding of it.
Mm.
Okay, so let's do the first one. Ten words
or
less.
Don't ask me what sound art is.
You're trying to express the inexpressible.
It's putting sound first as an art practice, I suppose. So you're not, you know, we use our eyes predominantly, but actually our ears are giving us a huge amount of information. And I'm really interested in listening styles. And someone like Michel Chion, who's one of the theorists I used in my PhD, talks about three different forms of listening that you can bring to your attention anywhere. You don't have to be an artist to do this. You can just do it as a passerby, as it were. So if you listen causally, you're listening to the cause of the sound, you're listening in a reduced way, which is what is the sound, what constitutes the sound. So is it grainy, is it loud, soft, is it intermittent, is it does it have a pitch, you know, all those sort of things. Lots of questions about the nature of the sound itself. And then the third aspect of the listening approach is to listen semantically. So what are you bringing to and from the sounds you're hearing? What associations do they have for you? And it might be to do with memory. It might be pleasant or unpleasant memory. But, you know, something like a bell might take you immediately back to your school days. You might then have that particular sort of sense of place and era mm-hmm. in your mind. So I try and use those three ways of listening in the art practices to suggest place, but also materiality, because everything we have around us, I could tap on a few things here. Here's my biro. Yeah. Here's paper flicking. You know, these are all material things and you're hearing them. Exactly, that's your cup. Our ears are giving us information all the time about the materiality of our surroundings. I find that quite fascinating. It's just something to pass on to people. I also do sound walks, which will unpack some of that too when I've got a group of people signed up. And then as an artwork, it becomes out as a series of discussions. It might come out as a performance in a particular place. I've done text scores so that people can then almost reenact the sounds in their mind when they're reading about a place through those particular sound lists. So I'm not sure. I'm experimenting with lots of different ways of working with sound and text at the moment, and also working with a colleague who runs the MA in novel writing in relation to narrative and sound, because we're very interested in how everyday sounds can then prompt narratives, which we're looking to try and harness in a series of few workshops at the moment.
Well, I have to say that I find that quite interesting. There's been an explosion of audiobooks, and which I'm delighted with. But many of the words that were not really meant to be read aloud, oddly enough, like they would be meant to be read, not listened to. I wonder if the interpretation of the work changes because of it being turned into a sound book rather than a read book. But who knows? That's
another conversation, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The sense of duration is one that then you're no longer in control of. I mean, when you're reading a physical book, you can stop and go back and go over things and, yes, you know, savour things in a way that perhaps you don't with an audio book. But then an audio book might then bring in sounds that can help appreciation of the text, I suppose. So,
yeah.
Swings and roundabouts, probably.
Undoubtedly. And you said that research can deepen our understanding of this. What kind of research were you talking about?
Well, how can I best explain it? I suppose if you're given a place to make a performance in, you look up something about the place in terms of its history, the usage of the place. So, I don't know, for example, I did some pieces in Brixton Market. I was asked just to perform live in Brixton Market. So I looked up the origins of the market. I tried to bring in some of the sounds that I could hear within the market. So there was a sort of element of mimesis involved in the...
What does mimesis mean?
Mimicking the sounds I could hear around me in the market.
Oh.
So it might be voices, or it might be the trundling of some of the trolleys.
No, I know exactly what you mean. Debussy used it in some of his pieces. He mimicked his daughter practicing her
arpeggios. Known as program music, actually, yeah. There's quite a history of program music, which is really interesting, and I certainly touched on that in my PhD. And it goes to absolute extremes when you get Wagner, for example, or Richard Strauss, and the program music is, you know, I don't know, Richard Strauss up in the Alps, you can hear... you can hear all the weather, you can hear the mountains, you can hear, you know, because he's written it into the music. I think that's really fascinating, the visualization through sound of place.
So you obviously at one point moved to London, because we're in London right now, talking in London. When did that happen, that you moved to London?
I came to London to go to the Royal College of Art for 2 years and never left. I was meant to leave. I just never left.
You're not the only one, Danzy.
And joined an orchestra, met a bassoonist in the orchestra. We got married and had kids.
So, oh,
you
true
know,
love.
It becomes much more difficult to leave them when you're absolutely embedded in the area. And, you know, South London's been very good to me.
So I just have to say, for those people who are Clapham listeners, because we're based in Clapham, and that you are almost local, because you're in Herne Hill, Brixton area.
Yeah.
So you're
Brockwell Park, lovely Brockwell Park.
Yeah, lovely Brockwell Park indeed. You lucky thing, you. So you're almost a local girl.
Do you know, I always think I come from the Midlands, and that my family were from Cornwall. I never say I come from London. It's weird, but yeah, of course I am. I've been here a very long time.
Okay. Well, I say to everybody, I'm a Londoner now.
You do that, do you?
Yeah, I do.
Do you say that?
Oh. Yes, I do. I say I'm a Canadian and I'm a Londoner.
Oh.
And people say, so where are you from? And I say, well, I'm a Londoner now. That's where I'm from. Mm. That's my shtick. You know, because otherwise it gets very complicated.
Well, yes. Yeah.
You say that South London's been good to you and you've enjoyed it here, even though you keep trying to leave.
I haven't tried to leave at all, really, but I mean, the work is here, isn't it? And the extraordinary community that is London in terms of the artistic opportunities and galleries, performances, you know, you can be anything you want to be in London. It's an extraordinary place. You can reinvent yourself in any genre, style. The cat is now walking across the laptop. I wonder whether...
Oh, this is not necessarily appreciated, I have to say, our cat, but she has been on other programs purring into microphones.
So if you want to talk sound.
About yeah, sound art, I keep trying to lock her out and she keeps wiggling her way in. So what's next for you, Tansy?
Just finishing co-editing a book on art, sound art, music, philosophy, performance, composition, which is going to be a set of about 13 essays on different aspects of all that, with a couple of colleagues, John Dack and Adam Stansby. And what else am I doing? Working with this novelist, Adam Lively, on narratives and sound in terms of materiality.
Well, this all sounds quite extraordinary, an extraordinary career that you've had, and a very vibrant career. I noticed that you have been abroad and worked abroad doing this as well. So tell us a bit about that.
I've been lucky enough to have a few residences, the opportunities to do residences abroad. So one was in Morocco in a little town called Sefrou, which is outside Fez, where, what was it called? The residency was called a text-based residency. And I just, my proposal was to make another sound score in terms of walking the streets, picking up the sounds, having discussions with people about the sounds that are particular to place, and then making a set of texts that related to that, and then giving the text to the residency people to keep as something, or using it as a sort of device later on, almost like a score. So that was extraordinary, and I did a lot of
wonderful things there, actually.
Yeah, it hasn't got out there enough. You know, Katie, I'm really bad at getting things out there. I make the stuff, but I haven't. I've had lots of galleries over the years, but I'm not being represented by anyone at the moment.
Well, look, you know, marketing is just...
seven different galleries, and it never really worked for me. So I'm doing my thing, and if it gets out there, that's great. You know, a lot of it arrives on the website, so that's like an archive of a lot of the material.
So, yes, I think we should all consult your website for more information. But I do think marketing is the dark arts. And we can't be held responsible for not knowing our dark arts well enough.
Yeah.
Marketing and accounting.
Exactly.
Those are the two bugaboos of being a creative individual, is that in order to be quote-unquote successful, we have to call on skills that...
we don't have, actually, sometimes.
Yeah. It's too broad a skill set.
All the networking business, I was never very good at all that. Ugh. So the dark arts of marketing, well, that's an interesting one, Katie, isn't it? So from my earlier days of working for publishing companies and record companies, where I was paid a fee either for a day rate or for the end product, as it were. Like, for example, for book covers for Penguin, which had come from the negatives and all the images I'd brought back from a British Council award to Prague, where I spent several months, through to maybe selling old works at exhibitions, although that's never been a particularly lucrative field for me. But I think it's more to do with just being out there. You know, I'd like to be out there more in some ways, just in terms of the ideas that I'm having, not necessarily in terms of the commodification of those ideas and selling things or stuff.
It's tricky because getting the ideas out there and the commodification of them are kind of intimately linked. They're intermeshed. You know, as soon as the ideas get out there, they become commodified. You know, the newspapers use it to sell papers. You could say, for example, if you really wanted to be a bit hard ass about this, you could say, I am commodifying you right now by putting you on Claire in Conversation. I think it'd be almost impossible to disengage, detach and separate out the strands of getting your work out there.
I suppose if you see it as making a contribution more than making money, that is of huge value to me. I mean, someone said to me the other day, but you're a conceptual artist, really, aren't you? And I hadn't really thought of it that way, but I suppose to some extent, yes, maybe that's what the work is about.
Well, what is conceptual art then versus...
That's another one. I don't want to go there.
I'm asking Tansy all these difficult questions, which is very unfair and not the point of this podcast. So,
what is conceptual art? Well, ideas are very important. Content is very important in anything you do as an artist. And I suppose conceptual art is the field where the idea predominates and the decisions you make about how that idea is then conveyed are possibly secondary or integral, certainly. So you might then make a set of decisions about the processes or the materials you make in order to convey your idea. Or the idea might come from the processes and materials themselves. You might find a process really fascinating and push it to its absolute boundaries until something breaks down or until it has a different sort of voice, and then that becomes the concept in its own right. So there are concepts embedded at many different stages of an art practice.
But surely that can't be new, Terence. I'm so sorry. I don't mean to sound like I'm...
It's had a label since the 60s, I suppose, but I don't suppose the artists ever gave it that label.
Yeah, I don't know how you could create anything without taking into consideration materials that you're using. You know, I'm thinking of Leonardo da Vinci, for instance, trying to paint frescoes with egg yolks and things like that, and how in an effort to create certain colours. You know, so.
But I think for him, if you think of his drawings particularly, you know, his mind wanted to find out something. And that's an extraordinary thing to see on paper. I mean, I don't know whether you've managed to get to the show. I haven't got there yet, but the show at the Queen's Gallery at the moment, of some of his Kodaks, is many of his drawings. You'll see him struggling with, you know, how does something work? How does a wing work on a bird? Yes. How do we take off if we try to be birds? And he invented the beginnings of a helicopter, you know. They're extraordinary things. So those concepts are there, absolutely built in. Yeah, of course the materials and the processes are important, but they're not the thing, you know. It's not that we're pursuing a sort of therapeutic wallowing in colour. I mean, okay, you could find artists who have wallowed in colour and made a thing of it, art brute perhaps, but then that concept becomes to do with of a sort of letting go or a sort of non-hierarchical use of colour in some way. This is very complicated.
It is. I'm actually learning quite a lot here, not just from what conceptual art is and sound art, but the whole complexity of the creative process. I think it's actually a process that's poorly understood.
Oh yeah, definitely. Oh, very maligned actually, and certainly in this country, you know, oh, you're just an artist, that sort of thing. But whereas in other cultures, I don't know, in the Czech Republic or Germany or even France, perhaps. There's more respect for what an artist can bring to, you know, to the conversation, to the table, in terms of what's important in our lives and how things need to change. Or
yes, I agree. Yeah, on that note, sense. I hope that you get the respect that you deserve.
Oh, gosh. whatever.
And whatever. We'll just be glad if you can get some more work. Thank you very much for joining us today, Terence Spinks, Senior Lecturer of Fine Arts at Middlesex University and sound artist, conceptual artist.
Indeed.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Claret in Conversation was brought to you by our sponsor, Clapham Publishing Services. It was executive produced, sound recorded, and edited by Teddy Edhoft. If you liked Claret in Conversation, please subscribe, share, and comment.